I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Several hundred years ago, nostalgia was thought to be an illness that soldiers experienced, not unrelated to homesickness. Today, movie and TV remakes are popular, so are classic songs, so are classic cars. And it's not unusual to hear people talk about the good old days, often when they were a much younger person. Today on Radio Times, we want to explore what makes us nostalgic. And to get us in the mood, here's a scene from Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, in which characters get to travel back to the early 1920s, a time when they consider the golden age of culture. Here's a scene with Owen Wilson as Gil, talking with Adriana, played by Marion Cotillard.
I was trying to escape my present the same way you're trying to escape yours, to a golden age.
Surely you don't think the 20s are a golden age?
Well, yeah, to me they are. I mean, and look at these guys. I mean, to them, their golden age was the Renaissance. And those guys probably imagine life was a lot better when Kublai Khan was around. I'm having an insight now. It's a minor one, but it explains the anxiety, my dream that I had.
What are you talking about?
Adriana, if you stay here, though, and this becomes your present, then pretty soon you'll start imagining another time was really your golden time. Yeah, that's, you know, what the present is. It's a little unsatisfying because life's a little unsatisfying.
I love that clip. Joining us is Jeff Pevere. He's arts and culture critic, a frequent contributor on arts and culture with the Globe and Mail. That's a Toronto-based newspaper, co-author of a book called Mondo Canuck, a Canadian pop culture odyssey, also the founder of the Blessed Diversion Network. That's a network of critical pop culture websites. And Jeff Pevere, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marie.
Also with us is Clay Rutledge. He's associate professor of psychology at North Dakota State University. He runs the Experimental Existential Psychology Lab in Fargo, North Dakota. His new book is called Nostalgia, a Psychological Resource. He also writes the More Than Mortal column for Psychology Today. And Clay Rutledge, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Clay, let me begin with you. Have we rebranded nostalgia from a couple of centuries ago? It's not considered a mental illness or a mental disease today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one possibility, is that people used to think nostalgia meant one thing, and now we consider it to be something else. But I also think it's possible that people didn't fully understand nostalgia because they didn't sufficiently distinguish it from homesickness. And so now what we have is an appreciation for the complexity of emotions towards the past. And nostalgia has kind of regained its proper place as a more positive emotional experience.
So how would you define it? And I'll get the same question to Clay. Jeff, how do you define it? How do you see it?
Well, I think in its common usage, and you know, I'm sure Clay would probably agree that that's not strictly the definition. But I think in its common usage, you know, when you refer to nostalgia, when you refer to feeling nostalgic, you do evoke positive feelings, and they are positive feelings that I think are often sort of activated or associated with certain things that we can experience that make us imagine our positive relationship to the past. And so I'm talking about, you know, especially today, whether it's television shows, whether it's music, there's all kinds of stuff that is available to us that allows us to kind of indulge in what are largely positive but probably pretty selective feelings about our own past. So I think it's a mechanism. It's also in many ways something which can be quite powerfully used to attract our interest as consumers if what is being offered is the promise of that good feeling.
And Clay, I've heard it described as bittersweet. I mean, I think we've all felt nostalgic, and there is a kind of bittersweetness to it. How do you see it, Clay?
Yes, I think that's correct. Nostalgia is what psychologists often refer to as an ambivalent emotion, which means even though, as Jeff pointed out, it's this largely positive emotional experience, it has this tinge of sadness or this tinge of loss. And that's what separates it, I think, from just a happy memory or any other type of pleasant emotion, is this complexity.
Is it this is to you, Clay. I mean, is it a healthy thing to do, to engage in nostalgia, or does it tell us that there's perhaps something in our present-day life that's not satisfying us?
I think both. So nostalgia is healthy in the sense that from about 10 years of research that we've done, we've identified nostalgia as an emotional experience that leads to a wide range of other positive experiences and positive psychological states. But it also, we often become nostalgic when we feel sad or lonely or meaningless. So it does suggest that we are using nostalgia as a response in part to present negative states as a way to compensate or restore some sort of psychological well-being.
Jeff, let me go back to you. And I'm thinking about, and we've all, it's happened to all of us, you hear some music from your adolescence or maybe early adulthood, and darn, if you aren't just transported back to that time and you remember who you were dating or who you broke up with, it's so interesting that these memories are so embedded in things like music.
Well, and they're so accessible. I mean, the fact is that, I mean, we can now kind of instantly create sort of nostalgic environments for ourselves, right? You know, and we can now store these things, and we can access them immediately. But I think, you know, as Clay was saying, it's interesting because it really is an ambivalent state. I mean, on the good side, what it allows us to do, as I say, is to access sort of what we feel are, I'm reluctant to even call them memories, because I often think they're projections of not what we actually remember, but ideal imaginings of what we probably would have liked the past to be. But at the same time, in order to do that, it requires a level of disengagement from the present. It requires a level of dissatisfaction with the present. But I think that, you know, the fact is that the other good thing about it, I would say, is that, you know, we can also build, you know, now communities out of our nostalgia. We can, you know, it may be at bottom, you know, an isolating feeling. It may grow out of isolation. But the fact is, when we can, you know, kind of reach out other people for whom, I don't know, you know, the Bay City Rollers are as important, you know, to them as it is to us, it does create a sense of community. But I think it's always ambivalent, because what it means is that you live in an eternal state where things are always never what they used to be. So there's a certain level of constant yearning and dissatisfaction, which I think it has to be at work there, or else it wouldn't exist.
Well, and the notion, I guess, Clay, of, you know, the so-called good old days, or in a sense sort of only remembering the good stuff and not remembering the bad stuff. What's the impulse there?
Yeah, I think it's part of the normal human experience to engage in a process over time of writing our own narrative as a way to remain healthy, and that is putting things into context and trying to extract the most meaningful information we can out of it. So sure, life is full of negative experiences and unpleasant experiences, but over time, what seems to be quite adaptive that humans seem quite good at, or most of us do, is being able to say, well, you know, I learned something from that experience. I grew from it. Life isn't entirely pleasant. Life isn't just one happy-go-lucky experience after another. And over time, that we preserve the meaningful elements of it and return to those elements through nostalgia, it allows us to be relatively psychologically resilient. And I would also add, which I think is important, is we're discovering in our research that sure, when you feel negative in the present, you become nostalgia, but nostalgia seems to mobilize you towards the future. In other words, we've done studies showing that after the experience of nostalgia, people want to go out and make new friends or meet new people, or they're more helpful or more charitable. So nostalgia doesn't just seem to pull people towards the past. It seems to help them resolve conflicts in the present and make them more oriented towards the future.
By remembering the so-called good stuff of the past, it's kind of inspires us to incorporate that in our present, Clay?
Yes, correct. So, for instance, nostalgia is predominantly social. Most of our nostalgic memories involve relationships with other people. And so when we're currently feeling lonely and we can turn to the past and say, you know what, I've had good relationships. I'm good at being a friend. I'm good at being a partner. Then that gives us the interpersonal competence and confidence in the present that we lack, and sort of gives us a little kick in the butt to say, you know, I can do this again. I can get back out there. I can rebound, and I can be successful socially.
Jeff, are you nostalgic for anything in particular?
Oh, boy. I mean, I think it's like probably with most people, it sort of comes and goes. I try to, you know, for the most part, you know, my nostalgia seems to just kind of come upon me. And I think this is the way it happens with a lot of people. And it's activated by things that kind of, you know, pass by me. It's sounds of music. It's smells. It's experiences. It's that kind of stuff. I mean, I think that the fact is, I mean, one of the things I've learned is that, you know, sort of my process of sort of revisiting, for example, movies and music and stuff like that from my past is, and this may also fit into the sort of the positive aspect of it that Clay was referring to, is that when I go back to certain, you know, pieces of music, movies and stuff like that, what I also find is that it enhances my experience of those things when I go back. It's not a sense of, you know, kind of I want to listen to something because it will transport me back, you know, to my parents' basement in 1972, where not very many good things happen. But the fact is that I did have my record player down there. But what it does do is it reminds me I am able to kind of engage in the present with those things that were meaningful for me from the past. And often through that process, what I can do is get a better acquaintance with kind of my own thinking and my own sensibility in the presence by understanding those things that mean a lot for me. So I think it's a really complex thing. I mean, I would be the pleasure. I'm not sure if there's a kind of a neurological effect in terms of the pleasure of nostalgia. Maybe Clay could talk about that. I would be interested in knowing if there's actually something going on in my brain when I hear something from the past or see something from the past that is meaningful to me and pleasurable to experience.
Yeah, and you can certainly feel it in the brain. Clay, we're almost up on a break, but is there something neurological going on?
I mean, certainly so, because nostalgia involves emotions, both positive and negative emotions, as we've talked about, and it involves sensory inputs, as Jeff mentioned, sounds, sights, smells. It involves self-awareness, because nostalgia is about reflecting on our own autobiographical experiences, and of course it implicates the memory system. So there's clearly a lot of different neurological systems involved in nostalgia.
And that's Clay Rutledge, and he studies nostalgia. Also with us is Jeff Prevere. He's arts and culture critic, a frequent contributor on arts and culture with the Globe and Mail. That's a newspaper based in Toronto. And we are talking about nostalgia, and this should get you in the mood. Let's listen to Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton singing the theme to the 1970s series All in the Family.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like me, we had it made. Those were the days. Didn't need no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G.R.O. was now ran great. Those were the days.
And you knew where you were.
Girls were girls and men were men.
Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again.
People seem to be content. $50 paid the rent. Freaks were in a circus tent. Those were the days.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. What makes you nostalgic? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And let me reintroduce our guests. Clay Rutledge is an associate professor of psychology at North Dakota State University. He runs the Experimental Existential Psychology Lab. That's in Fargo, North Dakota. And his new book is titled Nostalgia, a Psychological Resource. He also writes the More Than Mortal column for Psychology Today. Jeff Prevere with us as well, arts and culture critic for the Globe and Mail, a Toronto-based newspaper, co-author of Mondo Canuck, a Canadian pop culture odyssey, founder of the Blessed Diversion Network, a network of critical pop culture websites. And boy, pop culture and nostalgia seem to go hand in hand. And again, you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Jeff, this is to you kind of a softball question, but certainly look at all the movie remakes, you know, look at all the TV remakes that are so popular these days. And I'm assuming it's part people reliving these experiences they had when they were younger, and obviously introducing their children and young people that they know to what they so enjoyed.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, this is this Marty. I mean, that's where, you know, nostalgia as, you know, as an experience kind of, you know, converges with, you know, nostalgia as an industry and a very smart marketing move, right? Because the fact is that it's a lot easier to sell something that is familiar or to sell something that even holds out the promise of the satisfaction of the experience that you had when you were younger than it is to sell something, you know, completely new. So the fact is, you know, I mean, I don't know how many people have said to me in the last couple of weeks, it's like, have you seen the new James Bond? And the right. conversation will go something like, no, I don't like James Bond. Or it'll be, you know, well, I stopped watching James Bond after, you know, Sean Connery retired or something like that. So the experience of the film itself is very much kind of deeply associated with your memories of what has taken place. Look at all the anticipation for the upcoming Star Wars movie. And that's really interesting, too, because a lot of that conversation has to do with the fact that the movie is rumored to be full of nostalgic references to the early films. And based on that director, J.J. Abrams' past and his work with the Star Trek movies, the anticipation is the sense is that we are going to get a new Star Wars movie that will evoke our experience of the early Star Wars movies. So that is nostalgia at work as an industry, as a marketing tool, and basically as a kind of a really huge mass phenomenon.
I mean, that's nostalgia on steroids, isn't it, Jeff?
That's nostalgia on an intergalactic level is what it is. Yes, absolutely.
Clay, and we heard this in the Woody Allen movie Midnight in Paris, having a nostalgia for a time where you never lived. You know, a nostalgia for the 1920s. You know, a time that those characters and most of us have never lived. How does that work?
Yeah, so there's two different types of nostalgia. Well, at least two different types. And what we've been talking about so far is personal nostalgia, which is your own memories from your own life. Historical nostalgia is the other type, and it is what you're describing right now, which is our sentiment or our nostalgic feelings or a sense of connection to a time period that clearly we did not live in. And it's distinct from the personal nostalgia, of course, but one of the things I think that unites it is it's still about experiences or memories. They might not be our own, but they might be memories that we've somehow inherited. For instance, maybe when you were a kid, your dad listened to old records or mm-hmm. was interested in automobiles from the 1950s, and maybe you didn't grow up in that time. But through sharing those experiences with you, he's passed them along, and that connects us to older generations. So the movie examples that Jeff just mentioned, such as Star Wars. I mean, I was alive when Star Wars came out. I wouldn't remember it. But I'm wearing a Star Wars T-shirt right now. That's what's great about radio. I can be sitting here in my T-shirt and hoodie, and no one cares.
Well, you're out now.
Yeah, exactly. You just outed yourself, Clay.
I've exposed myself. But I'm super excited about despite the fact that I do research on nostalgia, it works on me. I'm cautiously optimistic that J.J. Abrams is going to deliver exactly what Jeff articulated, which is a return to the original films and the nostalgia associated with that, including the original characters.
Do you study nostalgia, Clay, because you are a nostalgic person?
Or
that's an interesting
you're a Star
question.
Wars fan.
Yeah, I'm a Star Wars. I am.
Yeah,
a
we
nostalgic.
Got that. Yeah, no, yeah. Go ahead.
I am a nostalgic person. I mean, for instance, I have old arcade games in my basement. I have an old video game collection.
Oh,
and
wow.
Certainly it's true that a lot of psychologists will say, well, my research is me search, or, you know, I'm studying things that I'm attracted to. But that being said, there is a fair amount of evidence that most of us are relatively frequently nostalgic. So it's an extremely common experience.
Jeff, sounds like you wanted to add something.
Well, no, it's just, I mean, what's really interesting to me is, in listening to Clay, but, you know, and the idea of kind of being nostalgic for a past that you weren't even present in is also really interesting. I mean, you know, if you look at something, for example, like, I would argue that probably the sort of the main constituency of viewers for the, you know, for the recently wrapped Mad Men series probably weren't there firsthand to witness the 1960s and its changes. That doesn't make any difference in terms of kind of allowing people to kind of indulge in the idea of the style, of the experiences of what is increasingly understood as an incredibly important decade in terms of changes in culture around the world. But the other interesting thing to me is, I think probably the greatest example of this kind of nostalgia at work was the most popular form of storytelling throughout the world and based in the United States during the 20th century was the Western. And the Western was a genre that was in its day as popular as science fiction, as fantasy are today, if not even more so. And that involved entirely a kind of projection of ideals onto a past that no one had lived through. But the convenient thing about that, of course, is that when you're dealing with, you know, the past, or in the case of Star Wars, a kind of a future, is that what you can do is you can project anything you want. You can idealize, and in fact, I think in many ways, the fact you weren't there to be contradicted by facts from the past or facts that haven't happened yet in the future makes it kind of even more resistible, because it does become, as I say, that kind of open slate for projection of dreams and desires in the present.
And Jeff, I grew up watching those Westerns, and to this day, I love Westerns. I love them.
Yes, no, you want to talk nostalgia for me? Okay, let's get right into it. I mean, the thing is, I'm a little older. I was like almost 20 when Star Wars first came out. So my relationship with Star Wars was a little bit different. But my relationship, for example, with Westerns were all over television when I was a kid, all over. Something like 8 of 10 of the top 10 network shows in the early 1960s were Westerns. Just imagine that today. The other thing is that, you know, I associated with my father. My father loved Westerns, and every time anything rode into town, no matter where we were living on a horse, we were there to meet it. So, yes, it's very much associated with that, but the Western itself is steeped in a kind of a historical nostalgia. The idea of the making of an ideal America, what sort of personalities, what sort of heroic figures would be involved, what were the values that needed to be tested in order that the country would become stronger. And on another level were those questions of what were some of the issues that were facing this idealism, what were the things standing in the way. So yes, I think nostalgia is very complex. And even in the All in the Family clip you played, which was fantastic, it's a song which actually, and that was a show which actually tackled the nostalgia, the selective and in some ways bullying nostalgia for an America that never existed, that Archie Bunker himself represented. Now we can be nostalgic for that television program. So it's a process which is also, I think, complicated and never ending.
Well, and Clay, just picking up on that, and then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. There does seem to be, certainly in this country, and Jeff, I don't know if this is true in Canada or not, but in this country, a nostalgia among some people for the 1950s, in many ways for the 1950s that didn't exist or only existed for white people, for instance, or for, you know, white men, if I can say that. But it is that seems to be a sort of a touchstone in this country.
Yeah, I think there's good reason to suspect that whenever there's any type of social upheaval or distress or anxiety, such as the economic downturn or recession, you see this increase in nostalgia for these past decades because, as Jeff pointed out, people aren't necessarily focusing on the negative aspects, such as the prejudice or discriminatory policies and behaviors, but they're focused on the idea of a simpler time or a more prosperous time or a more stable time. And so what they're essentially trying to do is, when there's a lot of uncertainty, they're seeking to right the ship, to stabilize themselves. And they do so by revisiting something that, you know, they may not be remembering correctly. It may not be remembering at all because it's not part of their personal history, but it helps give them some sense of stability or psychological security.
And that's Clay Rutledge, who joins us along with Jeff Pevere. We are talking about nostalgia. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Genevieve from Delaware to join us. Genevieve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if certain people are prone to nostalgia more, like the people that hold on to ticket stubs more or hoard items from their past and can't let them go.
Ah, that's an interesting question. I'm going to toss that to our psychologist. Clay, you want to take that?
Yeah, definitely. It's a great question. Yeah, it turns out there is a trait or a nostalgia proneness, as the caller rightly called it, that varies from person to person. Now, on average, most of us are nostalgic, oftentimes a few times a week to several times a day. But there are differences. There are people that are extremely nostalgic, and there are people that nostalgia is more of a rare experience. And this seems to be related to other traits, such as a need to belong or social orientation. It turns out that people who are more worried about relationships, care more about connecting to others, tend to be more nostalgic because nostalgia is a very social emotion.
That's interesting. Jeff, do you think there's a connection between nostalgia and, I'm thinking of the holiday season upon us, Thanksgiving and Christmas, Hanukkah, all the other celebrations that we associate with Hanukkah, often family celebrations. Do you think that taps into a mood of nostalgia?
Oh, I think that, yeah. I mean, depending on how you look at it, it's either the deepest or the most ruthless well of nostalgia. I think that when it comes to sort of nostalgic shorthand, in many cases, the idea of, the hearth at Christmas time with the family and all those associations is probably one of the most potent single nostalgic images there are. And you don't even have to have been there for that one, right? You don't even have to. I mean, that is an image which I think is capable, not necessarily so, but having a kind of a power which is which means you don't have to actually celebrate the holidays that way. But also the essence of Christmas, as it tends to be celebrated commercially, as in pop culture, is all about the past, all about the family, all about generosity, all about forgiveness. So in many ways, kind of some of the most powerful and evocative emotions which are suggested by the nostalgic experience can all be kind of, fit underneath the Christmas tree. Absolutely.
I mean, Clay, marketers know all about nostalgia, right?
Yeah, in many ways, marketers were discovered the power of nostalgia before psychologists because...
Absolutely, yeah.
They were using nostalgia as a marketing tool long before some of us got into the game and started to identify, well, why exactly is nostalgia working as a marketing tool? In fact, you could say marketers tipped us off because where people used to think nostalgia was a negative emotional experience, once people started to realize that, no, people are spending their time and money to consume nostalgia, it made psychologists start to suspect, well, maybe there's something positive or valuable or adaptive about it.
I mean, just,
I think Coca-Cola has an awful lot to do with this
right.
phenomenon. I mean, because in many ways, quite literally, Coca-Cola was the product which first dressed Santa Claus entirely in red, but also was one of the smartest companies to kind of associate its product with that deep well of Christmas nostalgia. Absolutely.
There's a song, it's a Stephen Stills song from Judy Blue Eyes, and there's a line from this. This is maybe more on the bitter side of the bittersweet. I'll toss this to you, Jeff. Don't let the past remind us of what we are not now. And I can hear that song in my head here. But, this is a reminder. First of all, I think it's a great line, but it sort of taps into the bitterness of the bittersweetness of nostalgia.
I think, you know, and I imagine Clay would probably concur with at least, you know, part of this, is that if nostalgia becomes a complete retreat from the present, if nostalgia involves a denial of a lot of things, your own experience, or a denial of things that are changing in society that might unnerve you and might upset you, then I think it can become a little bit dangerous. It can become the emotional equivalent of a narcotic that you take in order to escape. But I think as long as you are using it as a way, as I say, to kind of like reevaluate the present, or as Clay pointed out earlier, to perhaps, you know, draw some strategies for yourself of how to cope with the future, then I think it's a completely different experience. One thing that isn't going to happen is it ain't going to go away very soon.
Unfortunately, we can't take any more calls, but I'll just read Dennis's comment. Dennis from Bear, Delaware says, sometimes when you look at something that you want to feel nostalgic for, it's not what you want it to be. And of course, that's, I guess, Clay, the risk of going back in your past and realizing, oh my gosh, this is not what I remember.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of nostalgia, which is often underappreciated or we don't necessarily think about a lot, is nostalgia can be a painful learning experience too, and that is we can reflect back on the experiences and we can highlight the negativity of them. For example, maybe you're nostalgic for I'll give you a really good example, which we collected nostalgic narratives from older residents in the UK, and many of their nostalgic experiences were about times during World War II, horrible times of being separated from their family and enduring long periods of German bombardment. But they still have these nostalgic memories, and what they say is it makes them appreciate life, that they're grateful for life, that they're thankful. So nostalgia, even about these negative experiences in life, can be associated, I think, with some type of wisdom, a perspective taking of how to really cherish life and how to appreciate these very sacred and meaningful memories.
Well, that's a perfect place. And Clay Rutledge and Jeff Pevere, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
I'm already nostalgic for this conversation, by the way.
Absolutely. And let's play a little Michael Jackson. This is Remember the Time from his 1991 album, Dangerous.
Do you remember how it all began? It just seemed like heaven, so I did.
This is Radio Times. We were just talking about nostalgia, a good lead into this interview about Michael Jackson. Radio Times producer John Aaron's guest is music journalist Steve Knopper.
It's been over 6 years since Michael Jackson died at the age of 50. His musical legacy still looms large, with many of today's biggest stars trying their best to imitate the voice and emotional power that the King of Pop brought to the world. But his personal life still remains a mystery. His ever-shifting appearance, the bizarre dispatches from his Neverland Ranch, and a slew of child molestation charges were easy fodder for public scrutiny, as well as muckraking journalists seeking a scandal. Veteran music reporter and Rolling Stone contributing editor Steve Knopper has avoided many of the trappings of writing about Jackson in his new book, MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. The book is an attempt at an unbiased biography of the late performer and is a straightforward account of Jackson's ascent to superstardom, his musical process, and the constant tumult that enveloped him late in life. Steve Knopper joins me now to discuss the life of one of music's most talented and enigmatic figures. Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
So your book is almost divided into two sections. The first half highlights the young and unbelievably talented singer with the Jackson 5, who eventually breaks out to find his own voice. The second is a scandal-ridden and declining performer continually fighting to justify his erratic behavior. So I'm wondering, what drew you to write a definitive biography of MJ? The music or the man?
It was the music for sure, and I have to tell you that it did kind of divide up as you described, but I enjoyed writing about the music much more than I enjoyed writing about, you know, child molestation trials and things like that. It was listening to Michael's music and watching old videos and replaying the moonwalk over and over again. That was just a joyful experience for me. And then when I had to start writing about what was essentially cop reporting, really, it just became very sad. And you have to write that stuff, but it was definitely the harder part of the book.
And why use the term genius?
Well, I think he clearly was a genius. People think of him as sort of a song and dance man, which he was. But really, I think people don't think about the degree to which he was really a Renaissance man. I mean, he, like Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, or even if you want to go this far, Mozart, you know, he heard entire symphonies in his head and fully formed songs down to the bass lines and the keyboard bits and the lyrics. And he just needed this evolving group of people, most particularly Quincy Jones, to sort of help him write it down and translate it into a song in the studio. So he was a great, great songwriter, I think. Obviously a great dancer. I think that's beyond question. And in addition, I think he's a very underrated singer. All those little vocal tics and pops and woo-hoos and tee-hees that he did were completely unique. So I think the more you immerse yourself in Michael's music, the more you realize that he was the center of it. He was the guy that created it, and he maintained it all the way from 5 years old, really, all the way up until his death.
I do want to get to Michael as songwriter a little bit later, but first I want to play an isolated vocal track from an early Jackson 5 song called Never Can Say Goodbye, because it just sounds great.
Never can say goodbye. No, 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 I never can say goodbye. Every time I think I've had enough, I start heading for the door. There's a very strange vibration piercing me right to the core. It says, turn around, you fool. You know you love me more and more. Tell me why. Is it so? Don't want to let you go. I never can say goodbye, girl. Ooh, ooh.
So there Michael is 11 years old. Is his genius on display there?
Absolutely it is. I mean, that is some incredible singing right there. I mean, I was kind of getting chills as I was listening to that one. I did an interview, several interviews with a woman named Susie Akeda, who was one of Berry Gordy's top assistants at Motown while the Jackson 5 were there. And she wound up being a bit of a liaison between the company and the Jackson 5. And she, through this process, developed this very kind of sensitive, caring relationship with 11-year-old Michael at Motown. And she would tell me about how Motown would give Michael a tape and say, you know, here's the song, go home and learn it. And she said that most singers, even the experienced professional ones at Motown, needed several days to go home and really learn it and live with it and sit with it and figure out what the ins and outs of it and the phrasing and so forth was. Michael would come back the next day and be ready to go and sing just like what we just heard. And when he was 11, he had this instinctive ability to hit those high notes better than anyone else. I mean, I don't really think there's a voice like him in pop music.
Getting to Michael's songwriting, it sort of happened toward the end of his time with the Jackson 5 and as he's embarking on a solo career. You know, after years of covering songs and having songs written by professional songwriters, Michael's beginning to write his own. Can you tell me how he began songwriting?
The first instances of Michael writing songs are kind of him being in studios and running off a groove. This happened on the Destiny album when he and the keyboardist Greg Fillinganes and the drummer Ed Green were just kind of vamping. You know, they were kind of like a bass line, a drum line, and kind of going in a loop. And they did this for 20, 30 minutes, and eventually that became Shake Your Body Down to the Ground. And then he kind of kept doing it in that vein. I think a lot of his songwriting started out with this groove idea. But as he went forward, he became more sophisticated lyrically. I think he learned a lot from Berry Gordy and the songwriters at Motown. But in addition, he was working with Quincy Jones and Quincy Jones's stable of people. And so I think Michael is being influenced and learning from this stuff as he went. And he had such this incredible ability to take what other people had done and internalize it and kind of spew it back out into his own thing. And in addition to that, he had access to all these master class teachers. You know, if you're a great dancer and you have the ability to learn directly from James Brown, or you're a great arranger and you have the ability to learn directly from Quincy Jones, you're just going to get better and better. And I think that's what happened with Michael.
I'm going to go back and play an early version of Shake Your Body Down to the Ground, which you say is the first song he ever wrote, sort of in that groove-based model based on vamping by some of the session guys. So let's take a listen to an early version of Shake Your Body. One of the things I notice when I listen to that, and just when I listen to Michael Jackson in general, is just how percussive his singing is. His lyrics are very percussion-based. They sound like drums. And he also adds in all these ahs and different vocal ticks. Where do you think he picked that up from?
I mean, James Brown is an obvious answer. You know, James Brown did very similar types of things with his voice. But Michael just had this kind of instinctive way that he would sing and pop and scat. You're right. It's like its own instrument. It's almost like a bebop jazz instrument in a way in this pop song context. I mean, I'm an aficionado of how he does that from song to song. Like, you listen to Billie Jean and he doesn't just sing the lyric. He kind of pops up over the lyric and pops down under the lyric. It's just fascinating the way he does that. It's very difficult to imitate even when you're just singing along.
Yeah, speaking of Billie Jean, he wrote that in his home studio, right? It seems like, you know, with Shake Your Body, he had a crew of session musicians helping him. But eventually he built his own home studio where he could write on his own. And I have an early demo version of Billie Jean where he's sort of sketching out the idea for the song. Let's take a listen to that.
More kicking stuff in the phones. I need it. More bottom and kick in the phones.
That's a little peek behind the curtain to see sort of how that song came together. Clearly the chorus was fully there, but everything else had yet to work itself out. Did you get a chance to listen to a lot of early versions of MJ songs?
I did. I mean, yeah, some. That version in particular, that's fantastic, and I love listening to that. More kicking stuff in the phones. Somebody should use that as an album title. That's
or
great.
Sample it or something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that particular session, so Michael had sort of the A team and the B team. And the A-team was the Quincy Jones team in the high-priced studios. And then the B-team was, as you said, his home studio at his Havenhurst home with his family that he built. And he would bring in a succession of musicians and engineers to help him sort of translate these ideas that he heard in his head into instruments. And so those guys helped him translate that to that early demo. And then later, Michael took that demo to the studio where Quincy and his boys kind of Quincy'd it up.
And that song obviously went on to be one of his biggest hits and sort of a defining moment in his solo career. But it seems like going solo for Michael, both musically and creatively, but also in terms of his own life, that was always a struggle for him. He always had people trying to tell him what to do. It's sort of a theme throughout your book. And I'm wondering, do you think Michael Jackson was a good decision maker? Should he have been in charge of his own decisions?
Yes and no. I mean, and it depends on different points in his career. I mean, certainly early on during the Thriller days, all the way up to, let's say, mid-90s-ish, he was making really good decisions. He had a lot of people around him who were smart, who were, you know, John Branca, his attorney, led him into the deal where he bought the Beatles catalog and turned it into what is now Sony ATV. And that turned out to be an incredibly lucrative investment. And you know, he had an entourage that he could trust. His manager, Frank DeLeo, for a long time was somebody who was sort of like his right-hand man who was really looking out for his interests. Eventually, Michael started to, as more and more stuff happened, beginning with these accusations of child molestation in 1992, 1993, Michael started to develop a bit of a mistrust among his advisors. I mean, this was something that had been brewing for a long time. So he fired a bunch of them. He broke with Quincy Jones, which, you know, was a move for musical and creative independence. But there was a series of steps that Michael made that kind of deleted all those longtime trusted advisors from his life. You know, I think he had a struggle to get trusted people into his life beginning at that point. And he would constantly be hiring new people, firing people, hiring them again. And then his whole sort of management structure was filled with all kinds of different people who had conflicting interests. And some were yes men and some were competing with each other. And that was a struggle for him, I think, through all the way to the end of his life.
Yeah, it seems like the yes men sort of ended up being his downfall.
In a way. I mean, certainly we're talking about someone who had issues with addiction to drugs. You know, that often makes people behave erratically and make not great decisions in their life and in their business and in other ways. Certainly we've seen that in pop music all over the place. And you know, this certainly happened with Michael.
So elephant in the room when talking about Michael Jackson is obviously the string of child molestation charges, which you cover very thoroughly. Did you gain any clarity on the legitimacy of these charges?
I feel like I did. What I did was I went into it trying to be persuaded. You know, the old journalistic method where you interview both sides and you sort of try to figure out who's going to persuade you. And so on one hand, I'm very sympathetic to the view that if a child accuses an adult of molestation, you have to take that child's charge very credibly and very seriously. On the other hand, if I was going to suggest that Michael was guilty of child molestation, I had to get over a big hurdle, which was the fact that he was declared not guilty in a very legitimate trial that had a very well-funded and aggressive prosecution. A lot of people assumed that Michael would be found guilty at that trial, and much of the media coverage at that time was slanted in that direction. But looking back at it, when you go through all the trial transcripts, you talk to the attorneys on both sides, which I did, I just found that I personally couldn't find any evidence that would suggest that that verdict of not guilty shouldn't stand.
Well, Stephen Knopper, thank you again for joining us on Radio Times. I want to close out with a bit of MJ history that I had missed. It's the song DS from the album History. This is where Michael calls out District Attorney of Santa Barbara Thomas Snedden by name as he was leading the child molestation crusade against Michael Jackson. And again, that was veteran music reporter and Rolling Stone contributing editor Steve Knopper, who joined me to discuss his new book, MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. For Radio Times, I'm John Ahrens.
And for more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.